Chapter 20. Harvest, February 23, 2525. Overnight, the mall had cleared. At dawn, there were no refugees, no constables. All had moved in the night to the elevator sheds. As Captain Ponder strode eastward across the park, he saw half-drained drink cartons, unzipped luggage, and ransacked clothes. Here and there were diapers, foul-smelling rags, and crumpled hollow stills. The once beautiful mall had become a trash heap, a dirty and disorganized monument to Harvest's abandonment. After placing a beacon at the center of the mall to mark a landing zone for the aliens, his staff sergeants had wanted to remain at the LZ to set up sniper hides and cover Ponder during the handoff. But the captain had refused. Healy had insisted he at least drive Ponder from the Parliament across the mall, but the captain had just ordered the corpsman to wrap him in a new cast, give him some meds, and set him on his feet. This wasn't stoic pride. Ponder was just eager for one last march. Some Marines hated marching, but Ponder loved it, even his first grueling road hikes and basic training. Since his demotion, he'd sometimes joked how lucky he was to have his arm blown off. If the Innie grenade had taken one of his legs, his punchline went, he probably would have learned to walk on his hands. Not the best joke ever told, but even now, it made him chuckle. That made him wince and suck air through his teeth. Despite his new cast, one of his shattered ribs had shifted against his already ruptured spleen. There was nothing Healy could do for such a serious injury, and there wasn't enough time for an operation at Utgard's hospital. Not that Ponder would have agreed to it. Some missions were best handled by dying men, the captain knew. And giving the aliens their oracle was one of them. The knoll at the center of the mall was topped by a fountain and a bandstand, and surrounded by a ring of old, gray-barked oaks. As Ponder hunched past the trees, their heavy branches rose as if they were stretching up in anticipation of Epsilon Indy's ascent. But Ponder also felt his abused organs rise inside his chest, and he realized the real cause of the oak's elation even before he cleared their canopy and could once again see the sky. The alien warship was dropping toward Utgard, and its anti-gravity generators were cushioning its descent with an invisible, buoyant field. Under different circumstances, the captain might have felt fear as the massive vessel came to rest perpendicular across the mall, no more than a few hundred meters above Utgard's highest towers. But the anti-grav field did a better job of managing his pain than any of the meds Healy had given him. As the warship came to a groaning stop, Ponder inhaled deeply. For a few glorious moments, he breathed without effort, without feeling the steady throb of blood from his spleen. But the relief dissipated as quickly as it came. As the alien ship stabilized and dialed its field generators back, the captain was forced to trudge up the hill to the bandstand, bearing the full weight of his trauma. It didn't help that he also carried the brass-bottomed hollow projector from the governor's office. Ponder still had only one arm and couldn't shift the object's weight. To make matters worse, Lieutenant Commander Alcigny had fitted a round, titanium-cased network relay to the bottom of the projector. She'd wanted to use a lighter model, but Loki, Harvest's long-dormant PSI, had insisted that a more robust relay was required. Ponder had been too weak in the governor's office to concentrate fully on Loki's explanation of the plan, but he understood that the aliens were looking for a powerful, networked intelligence, something they called an oracle. And thanks to an apparent traitor in their ranks, Loki had learned he could fake the oracle's electronic signature by filling the relay with an excess of data traffic. Staff Sergeants Johnson and Byrne had a hard time trusting intel from a hostile source, especially after what the aliens had done to Gladsheim. And in fact, when Alcigny had revealed her and Loki's complete plan, the Marines had initially exhibited some of Governor Thune's outrage. If they were going to try and sneak all of Harvest's remaining citizens past the alien warship, why the hell would they want to lure it closer to Utgard? Suddenly, one of the alien dropships emerged from a glowing portal in the warship's stern. It swooped past the tiara's seven brilliant strands, like a tuning fork testing the pitch of an oversized piano's wires. As Ponder climbed the bandstand's wood plank steps, he noticed the dropship held four objects in a wavering blue suspension field between its bays. When it slowed and the objects fell free, the captain realized they were vehicles of some sort. The instant they touched the ground, their toothed wheels began to spin. Then, spewing clods of dirt and grass behind them, they began a rapid, clockwise reconnoiter of the oaks around the knoll. Each vehicle was driven by one of the armored aliens. Ponder recognized the tallest from the botanical gardens, its tan fur bristling from gaps in its blue armor. But the leader was a red-armored beast with shiny black fur, who angled its vehicle up the knoll and came to a rumbling stop between the bandstand and the fountain. Ponder noted two things as the alien dismounted. First, the vehicle's seat remained elevated off the ground, evidence of some limited anti-gravity capability. Second, the vehicle was armed with a pair of the alien's spike-flinging rifles. These were crudely welded to the top of what the captain assumed was the vehicle's engine. Cables snaked from the rifles to the vehicle's elevated steering handles, an arrangement that would allow the driver to fire and maneuver at the same time.